Bernard Gill, Hillsboro, North Dakota, now.
Where were you born?
Well, in the dining room on a farmhouse out west of Rockford, Illinois. And Rockford, Illinois is the official birthplace because that's the county seat.
Oh. Who were your parents and what did they do?
Well, my father's mother was born in County Tipperary, and that's always appealed to me greatly. And his father came from Dublin, but the name Gill is an English name, just even more than it's an Irish name. And I think possibly Richard Hackett Gill came out of an Anglo-Irish background. Anglo-Irish background. My mother's maiden name was Campbell, Camp Bell, and her folks came over in the 1700s, New England people, from New England to Northern Illinois. And my father was he would have been a marvelous museum curator. He would have been marvelous as that. But he did this and he did that, and during the Depression he didn't do much. And we did not exactly have any excess money during those years, but they were fine folks, and I enjoyed them part of the time.
How big a town was Rockford?
In those 20s and 30s, it was about 80,000. It got up, after the Second World War, it got up close to 100,000, and now it's settled back down. The city itself is settled back down to about 90,000, but the greater metropolitan area, I guess they call it now, would be, I have no idea what they, if you count all the little towns that have kind of coalesced there.
Where did you go to high school? Was that Rockford too?
In the old Rockford Senior High School. A marvelous place, composed of a new building that was built in the 1920s. And then there were older buildings, and one of those down in the basement was affectionately known as Rat Alley. And then clear to the south, the very southernmost building, was the old Rockford Watch Company building. The Elgin Watch Company bought that, and I had classes in zoology anyhow, in the old Rockford Watch Factory. And you could sit there in the classroom and look down on the big planks in the floor and see the marks where the big, say 8x10 marks and the bolt holes still left where the machines had been fastened. But what may be more interesting, we were the next to the last class to graduate from the Central High School. It then split up into three separate, east, west, and down south. East and west, and then that had the name of a beloved Italian priest. And they gave that school, that public school, the priest's name. And I can't recall that. And but there were 798 in my graduating class. And then I got a little scholarship to Beloit, and Beloit College then had 420, and it seemed like an awful small operation to me after that enormous old high school.
When did you graduate from high school?
39.
Mm-hmm. And then you went right on to college?
Yes, I went right up to Beloit that fall, but then money ran out, and I dropped out and worked in a factory for a while, and then went down to the University of Illinois, where I got my degree. Well, this is World War II. I remember the front porch I was sitting on, and the fellows who were sitting around there on December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day, and we kind of figured that might change our lives a little bit. And it must have been after that I got into that U.S. Naval Reserve V-7 program, which allowed people to continue and not always finish, but at least continue for a while in their with their college work before they were called up. The others in my midshipman school had some of them had graduated with me in 43, but others had been sophomores and juniors, and by 1943 they needed people, and they were called up, and they did not finish before they were called into service. And it's rather fun to be able to say, oh, I attended Columbia University in New York City. But, of course, it was the Naval Training School. The Navy Reserve took over several of the dormitories and so forth and so on. And I think it should be pointed out that I was not a 90-day wonder. I was a 120-day wonder. Because we were in that long.
Yeah. What was your military training like at Columbia? What was your military training like at Columbia?
Oh, my. There was some old parade ground, fooling around, marching up and down and in and around, and we'd gather on some big street between the old library and a space and then the new library. I don't remember the names of those streets or avenues or anything else. But we'd gather there and we'd left face and forward march and we'd walk around, and I think that was to keep us occupied. The 95% of it was classwork, paperwork, bookwork. And we studied, of course, we were supposed to learn such things as naval terminology so that we wouldn't call a line a rope and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then weaponry and plane recognition. Plane recognition, we spent a lot of time on recognizing, especially enemy, but recognizing both ally and enemy airplanes. And interestingly enough, considerably less time recognizing other naval vessels. But I think weaponry and recognition of airplanes covers a lot of it. I'm sure, you know, what is it, 60? No, it isn't 60, but it's between 55 and 60 years. One is allowed to forget a little bit, I think.
Absolutely. Any special memories during that time of training?
Oh, sure. There was a very dear girl who I met at a church. And you see, on Sunday, after the noon mess, and I just recently discovered that the Western Geological Formation called Mesas, the M-E-S-A, mm-hmm. that, I guess that's just Spanish for table. Mm-hmm. And our naval and army mess and mess halls is related. It just comes out of the Spanish word for table. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, after noon mess and until, I think we were allowed to stay out until 6 o'clock Sunday evening, that whole afternoon we were free to go any place we wanted to. And somehow I had Joan D'Arc was her middle name, Joan. She was just a sweet young lady. And she took delight in, I wondered, you know, what do you do? Well, I'm a blockhead. Blockhead? Well, yeah, in a bank. I work in a bank, and there's a block. They divide the cashiers up into a block, and I'm head of that block. I'm a blockhead. And but she's just a real nice girl, and that's a pleasant memory. And then one afternoon, also, I went up to the Riverside Cathedral and climbed up through the carillon while it was playing. Gigantic bells, 6-8 feet across, tiny little bells, it's no bigger than a water glass. And, oh, it was just, that was an experience, climbing up through that while it was playing an afternoon carol. Got up to the top, and I looked off to the south, and, yeah, I could recognize the Empire State Building, but I wasn't quite sure. I wonder which one is the Chrysler Building. There was another man there. I asked him, "Do you happen to know which one of those buildings is the Chrysler Building?" "No, I'm not from around here." "Oh, well, I'm from Illinois. Where are you from?"
"Brooklyn."
And, oh, there are other, oh, a friend of mine from the university, he was working on his doctorate down there, Zhou Yu Qing, or more simply pronounced Y.C. Chow. It was a Chinese student. And he looked me up, and he took me to, he saw to it that I saw, the crazy nephew thought he was Theodore Roosevelt. The ladies were burying people in the basement. What is the name of that drama? And another nephew had a sweetheart, and he just couldn't imagine getting married related to that kind of a bunch, you know. And then it turned out that he'd been adopted or something. He wasn't really related. And Boris Karloff played the part of, well, if I can't remember the name of the drama, I better quit talking. But he got me to a couple of well-known plays going on in New York there during those 1943. And those are mostly, we marched over to Riverside Cathedral every morning at, I don't know, for 9 or 10 o'clock for services over there. Ah, the big, as far as I know, it's still under construction, some enormous interfaith Riverside Church, I guess they say, Riverside Church. And this other one is something-something Cathedral. And it was huge. And it was under construction. And they were, you know, they'd bring in European stone artists for the carving and so forth and so on. And within the last decade or two, something that I read indicated to me, it's still under construction. And, well, you know, those medieval, those great monasteries that were built when they got through the year 1000. And what do you know? The world didn't come to an end. And so that 11th century was just a great period of expansion and enthusiasm and cathedral building. And those great cathedrals took decades and decades and decades to build. Well, they're doing this the same way. It's handwork.
Mm-hmm. How long were you in New York for your training?
Just 120 days. I somewhere along in August, I was finally called up. You know, you graduate back in May or early June, and, well, you're under orders. You're going to get called up. When should I get a job? What should I do? So you sit and wait. In the service, you learn to wait a lot. And finally, it was August, so September, October, November, December. It would be about the end of January or the 1st of January, end of December or the 1st of January, and I was there from the end of August until the change of the year into 44.
And then where did they send you?
Down to Virginia Beach, out near Norfolk, Virginia. It was an amphibious ATB, there you go, ATB, amphibious training base. And we were to learn how to operate these LSTs here within the last year or so. An old LST number 325 was, and it had been loaned to the Greeks, and the Greeks had been using it, and they gave it up, and they found 18 or 20 or so of the old crew members, and they brought that ship back across the ocean and into one of the Gulfport harbors, where it's a floating museum for the old LSTs, landing ship's tank. And of course, winter on the Atlantic coast was an excellent time for training under difficult circumstances, because there were storms and great surf, and we'd go out there and be 10 below and the surf 10 feet high, and we'd practice how to get troops up onto the beach. And my main memory there was being immense, just terribly ill. I had a cold. Goodness. I had a fever, but it got up to 104 once or twice, but it never got above 104. And their sick bay was so crowded, you had to have a temperature above 104 to be admitted. And then a bunch of us were transferred to, and this troubles me, I cannot remember where we were sent someplace up the Chesapeake Bay to another kind of training base. And I was struggling my way toward Building 7. I think it was Building 7. And by George, over there, it was 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. And over there, the lights were on in a building. Okay. I'm going to go over there and get my regular dispensation of aspirin. And I went in, and, "Hi, I'd like to have some aspirin." "Well, sit down." And he stuck a thermometer in my mouth, and after a while read it, went back to his desk and started working paperwork. And I said, "Man, I'm tired. I'd like to get to my barracks and get to bed." Well, he said, "You're not going anyplace. You're in the hospital." And there I was for 3 or 4 weeks. I missed my regular. I was transferred to another group after all that time.
So what was wrong?
And pardon?
What was wrong?
Oh, just a terrible cold, and it had gone into my ears. That's a remarkable experience also. I just had awful earache. And went into a doctor's office, and he looked, and he said, we're going to have to relieve or puncture or something that eardrum before it bursts. And I thought, there'll be this, there'll be that, they'll give me some anesthetic, we'll probably go to another room. And no, he just said, "Well, we'll have to puncture that," and he picked up something and bing. And I still remember that red hot poker that went right up from my tailbone out through the top of my head, right up my spine, and then black. It was just the greatest pain I've ever felt. Just that little eardrum. And somehow or other that created an enormous pain. That is a rather sharp memory. Another...
How long were you out?
Oh, I was there 3 or 4 weeks.
I know, but when you blacked out from the...
I don't remember. I was back. I was back among the land of the living in just a few minutes, you know. It wasn't as if I were out for hours or anything like that. I just fainted. It was a protective reaction of the body.
Yeah.
But in there, in the next bunk, we didn't have private rooms. There was a ward and a whole bunch of us there. And there was a fellow there who'd been in the Navy a lot longer than I. But he was a younger fellow. And he thought that he'd found out the way to spend his time in the service. He was an excellent actor and could put on being ill. And except for a few days now and then, he'd spent his entire naval career in hospitals. But anyhow, I wasn't that good an actor, I guess. And I was transferred to another LST, and we went across the Atlantic through the Gibraltar Straits, and we could no more see that great rock that's in the insurance advertisement than you could see a black cat in the coal bin. And somebody explained, oh, well, you have to be around on the land side and inside the harbor and look out. And then you get that view of the great rock. But we went along the coast of North Africa, Tunis, you know, and I've been to Bizerte, and I've been here and there and the other place. We went by Salerno in Sicily. We put into port somewhere in Sicily. But basically, we were based in Naples there. And that is a beautiful bay, the Bay of Naples and the Isle of Capri. Mm-hmm. And Mount Vesuvius off to the southerly. Mm-hmm. I can't say it's south, but it's southerly. But that it's a beautiful bay, that Bay of Naples. And yes, you could see the Isle of Capri from there. And I got over to Vesuvius and that old, for heaven's sake, that old buried town from about 70 A.D. when Vesuvius erupted. Well, everybody else knows the name of that town, that they're still digging it out of ashes and so forth and so on. And Naples was a war-torn city. It was, well, for one thing, it smelled. Their sewage system had been bombed, and they were just getting themselves back together. But we would, we made some deliveries over to Sardinia, and I can't remember the name of the town. But the main thing there was Anzio. I'm able to say that, well, yes, I was at Anzio. And we would take supplies up there and then bring the foxhole, the real fighters, back to Naples for R&R. They'd get a little rest and recreation. And the LSTs were great, big, unmanageable bathtubs. They remind me of nothing so much as a bathtub, rather 300 and some feet long. But they were just big, hollow tubs. And unlike the destroyers, which had been designed decades before, and then modern equipment kept adding crew and adding crew and adding crew, and they were terribly overcrowded. The LSTs were designed right then, during World War II, and they were big enough. They had a huge refrigerator where we had fresh vegetables, and oh my.
How many people on an LST?
A regular crew, around 100, sometimes up to about 120. There were about a dozen officers and 90 or so crew members. And we had bunk rooms. The officers had little bunk rooms, you know, not as big as this little room we're in here now, but, you know, had our own bunks. And one of us on each side, but above them were two more bunks that could be let down. And when we were carrying troops back from Anzio, or much later out in the Pacific, why, the officers would bunk with the officers of the ship. But wherever we were, there was lots of room. And these men who'd been spending their time in foxholes in the rain had a dry bunk to sleep in. And they got freshly cooked food. And they just thought it was incredible. That 3 or 4 days it took us to get them from Anzio down to Naples, they thought, my boy, you guys really have it made aboard this LST. And for 2 or 3 days afterward, you didn't hear the usual griping about the lousy food we get around here and all around. That's, you know, you get that in the service. That's the enlisted men's privilege, and quite a few officers too. But after the NZO folks had been aboard, there was that quieted down for a couple days.
Counted your blessing.
Then, you see, we didn't, that awful invasion up north across the channel, the invasion of northern France on D-Day. How lucky can you be? I wasn't in on that. You see, there was the invasion of southern France, and we didn't know. We thought we were facing enemy troops and so forth and so on. And later on, we found out, or heard, that the closest Germans were about 250 miles north, beating their way up north to fight that off up there. As far as I know, there wasn't any opposition in that invasion of southern France. How lucky can you be? You know, that's great. I don't mind a bit. The only time I was ever under active bombardment or anything else was there in Anzio. And you see, the fact that you found out later that the bombers were after those bigger ships over there, when you were standing there and the magnesium flares were right up over you, and the bombers were coming overhead, there was just a little touch of apprehension. And but it was, they were after the big, they were after the big ships. And I wonder about the thinking of the German pilots, because every single bomb went between the freighters and the bigger ships. There wasn't a single ship hit. And I've wondered about that. I've wondered about that, if the Germans were thinking, this is so stupid. I don't know. I have thought about that. Well, maybe they were poor shots. I don't know.
But, lucky for us.
Yeah, lucky for us. Yeah.
Can you tell us about some of the people you met during the time in the service? Crew members on the LST?
Oh, my, I was in touch with the bunkmate, Arthur Herbert Noble. And he married Mildred Kindly. And he had a chuckle when he said, we were thought of as a noble and kindly pair. But he's probably the biggest person I've ever been closely associated with. He was about 6'7 or 6'8. And I said, well, I thought 6'4 was the max for naval. You just weren't allowed into the Navy after, if you were taller than 6'4". And he said, well, I wanted to be in the Navy rather than the Army. And I scrunched down as far as I could, and I got down to about 6'5.5". And they said, well, that's okay. And they let him in. But I've never thought anybody was a big person since I was around Arthur Herbert Noble. Nobby, of course, Nobby. And he was a fine fellow. He'd been in the textile business up in New England, and very soon after the Second World War, he was part of that great transfer of the textile industries to the Southeast. And during the next decade or so, I think South Carolina, possibly Georgia, I think South Carolina, but cheaper labor down there, so of course the textile factories moved down there. And I kept in touch with him. I don't think I kept in touch with any other people, any of the other people I met during the service. I still have some books of a fellow, and he has some of mine. We traded over, that was over in the Mediterranean. And I still have some of his books. I figure if I ever run into him, well, he can trade back again. But no famous people, no. I have a snapshot of Winston Churchill in a boat. He was going through before we went into this invasion of southern France. By golly, here came Winston Churchill in a speedboat, steaming, buzzing past the... And if you have a magnifying glass, you can see his hand up in the air, and with a good imagination, you can see his famous V signal. But it's just a little tiny snapshot, and in the snapshot, the boat's about an inch and a half long. And but anyhow, Winston Churchill went by, and we got a picture of him. Then we went back to New York for a refitting. Are we going? What was your next question?
You just keep talking.
Yeah. Well, things were pretty much over there in the Mediterranean, and we went back to New York. We were up in dry dock. We were being completely refitted. They'd invented better davits. That's those hoist things that hoist the small boats, the invasion boats, up onto the, be secured, and then lower them down into the ocean. We got new davits. I don't know what all. Lots of refitting went on, all kinds of welding and cutting and renewing. I foolishly left my wallet on a shelf about 2 feet from the porthole. And that was gone. And a few days later, one of the men found it down in a one of the tanks way down in the bottom. It had been tossed out. And everything was in there, my cards and everything. The money was gone. How lucky that, you know, I'm lucky. He could have thrown it in the ocean rather than down into that compartment. It was while we were in New York that my dad suffered an industrial accident. He had his leg crushed off. He was working. It was on a Monday. And that's part of my attitude toward drinking. This guy had been on a toot all weekend, and he drove right through the barriers, right across the tracks where my dad and his partner had the chain across the railroad track holding a hoist, and they were lowering a very heavy piece of equipment into place. And this binged out nut drove his little locomotive across there, cut the chain, and my dad was pretty spry. He jumped up in the air. It would have crushed him about waist high. But he jumped, and just one leg got crushed. But anyhow, I got permission to go home. I was home for 2 or 3 days then, just to visit my dad. Went back to New York. We took off Guantanamo Bay. I've been there in Cuba, and they're still arguing about that. The Cubans would like their Guantanamo Bay back, and the Americans say, "Well, we've had it for 100 years now, ever since the Spanish-American War. We ought to be able to keep it, shouldn't we?" And so forth and so on. And the Panama Canal, and across, and up to San Diego. And then, if you want one little taste of eternity, go across the Pacific Ocean in an LST, whose flank speed, in other words, the absolutely fastest it can go, is about 11 knots, which is a little over 11 miles an hour, and whose cruising speed is about 7 or 7.5 knots, which call it 8 miles an hour. 8 miles an hour across the Pacific. One gets an impression of eternity. But one of the beautiful things, we stopped at the Hawaiian Islands, though. That's just a short jaunt from San Diego to Oahu. And so I got to be on the Oahu, the Honolulu Island. And naturally, what I did was I found a bus that went up to the University of Hawaii. So I went up and got onto the University of Hawaii campus for about 10 minutes between buses, and then back down, had to get aboard ship again. And then west, our next, there were a number of other little islands in between, but eventually we got out to the Philippines. One very interesting, the skipper, Stephen Grady, little guy, he was, I think, he was shorter than I was, but he was a tough captain, I tell you. But we were all alone. It wasn't in a big group. There were 10 by 10 of us. There were 100 of us that went across the Atlantic over to the Mediterranean. We were alone, all by ourselves, one crazy old LST going across the Pacific. It was a beautiful day. The Pacific Ocean, you know, is named Pacific because it's so peaceful, in contrast to the stormy Atlantic. And we were just a glass-topped ocean. And Captain Grady stopped the ship. Let's go swimming out in the middle of the Pacific. I didn't. I was too. I'm too chicken. But a lot of the guys, and Grady, the captain, they're great front doors that open, and then the great ramp is lowered. And that was lowered until the far end of it was just dipping into the water. And they dive off that and swim around and clamber back up on. And I've kind of wished that I'd gone swimming out 1,000 miles from no place out there in the middle of the Pacific. That I thought that was so great of him to do that whimsical, goofy thing. But anyhow, we got out to the Philippines. We had a few other odds and ends of jobs. But basically, we were preparing for the... I keep hitting the table. Is that banging?
No.
Basically, we were preparing for the invasion of Japan. President Truman... still, every now and then, comes under criticism for dropping the atomic bomb on Japan. What a terrible cost in lives. Well, I'm sitting here talking into this microphone today because President Truman dropped that bomb. And yes, it was horrible, horrible, killing the residents of those two cities. It was horrible. But far fewer Japanese lives were lost than would have been lost had we invaded and bombed many more cities than just those two. The loss of Japanese life would have been huge. And, of course, the Allies would have lost uncountable lives. We were training to invade, and it turned into the occupation of Japan. But we went the exact same route, the same route that we'd been practicing, and looking at the maps, and, well, we go, you know, so-and-so, and degrees this, and turn so-and-so, and the route here. And we went up through these tall, tall rock formations. They were tiny mountains or big rock hills or knobs. They weren't flat on top like the mesas, but they were just very sharp promontory outcroppings. And you looked up there, and you could see the gun emplacements. And in many instances, you could even see the cannon up there in them, pointing right down. Talk about shooting fish in a barrel. We were supposed to go along there and get troops up onto the beach at Yoko, not Yoko, Wakayama. We were supposed to get into Wakayama, carry troops in there for the invasion. And we wouldn't have made it, because there would have been some, even under the most heavy of bombardment, some of those cannons would have been left. And just a couple of them would finish an LST, you know, poke a hole and down she goes. But anyhow, we went into Wakayama and occupying. And the very first fellows ashore would come back, look what I got for my mom or my wife or my sweetheart for a package of cigarettes. And he'd have a beautiful kimono. By that afternoon, for a carton of cigarettes, you might get the belt off of a kimono. They, you know, they catch on real quick. But Wakayama, then back and forth and back and forth a lot. And we went down to Ponape, P-O-N-A-P-E, is the way we spelled it then. I don't know how it's spelled now. The island of Ponape. And that had been a Japanese possession since the, for decades, maybe since the 1800s. But the people living there were third and fourth generations down from the people who had settled that little tiny island out in the middle of nowhere. Well, that was a Japanese possession, and they've lost the war. They'll have to give it up. Why? I didn't know. But that's what we had to do. We went down there and got a load of the Japanese who lived on that island and took them back up to Japan. And the only thing that I remember from that is the little kids wanted one of the crew members to answer over and over and over again, "Where are you from in America?" And he would say, "Ohio." And they'd laugh and laugh and laugh, because in Japanese, Ohio means something like good afternoon or something like that. "Where do you live?" "Good afternoon." They just thought that was the funniest thing. "Where do you come from in America?" "Ohio." We got them back up there. I can't remember any other assignments that we had. Before I get released up out of Yokohama and go back to the Philippines, I was... the LST had gone from... name forgotten, over to Tacloban in the Philippines. And I took a group of three small boats in for something or other. We were delayed. And the captain couldn't wait. He took the LST back to whatever our main base was then. And I said, "Well, fellas, we're just going to have to run these little boats all the way back there." And the little boats traveled about as fast as the LST. But I said, "Be sure your tanks are full and be sure there's lots of water aboard, because we can get along without food, but we'll need water." And I remember it was hot. I had a notebook in my pocket, and I fastened an umbrella for my nose, and some of the other fellas did too. But most of them had been out, and they'd been getting sunned and tanned, and they weren't going to be affected by the long exposure to the sun. And a little bit after dark, we got back. I wish I could remember the name, but it was further down, down at the southern end of the big island. But that was quite something, all that. I suppose it was 100, maybe 100 miles across open water. And it was interesting managing to get them there. You know, we didn't have, we had compasses aboard there, but we had no navigational instruments or anything. We made it. We got there. No problem. We just headed west.
Thank God for the compasses.
Yeah. And but then up in Japan, things were winding down. There wasn't a heck of a lot left to do. And
so when did
naturally,
you...
I applied for separation. Mm-hmm. And, well, yeah, fine.
Did that, you could apply for separation?
Then, yeah.
Oh.
But not when things were a little heavier. But then, yes, it became possible that, you know, we're all going to be dismembered. That's not the word. But anyhow, we'll be out of the service pretty soon. And if there are any special circumstances, well, I pleaded my dad's accident as special circumstance, and I was really... And in contrast with the eternal voyage westward... We voyaged eastward on a little tiny aircraft carrier. And man, I swear to goodness, that thing went 25 knots or something like that. It just flew through the water compared to the LST and got back to San Diego. And that's, I learned there how long that west coast is. Somebody was heading for Seattle. He was going to get separated up in Seattle, and I was going to get separated at Navy Pier in Chicago. And I said, boy, you're lucky. You're right here on the West Coast. I've got to go all the way to Chicago. Look at a map. What do you mean? Well, Seattle's further away from San Diego than Chicago. Is it? Well, just look at a map. And I looked at the map, and what do you know? There's a long distance between San Diego and Seattle. And I don't know that it's an easier trip, because to get to Chicago, you go across the Rockies and so forth and so on. And there was all that beautiful Rocky Mountains scenery and so forth and so on. And we went through it at night. And by the time daytime came, what were we going through? But the Great Southern Plains, almost as flat as the Red River Valley. But we got to Chicago, and I got back to Rockford, and I rejoined the world.
So what did you do?
Wondered what in the heck to do for a living. I taught for a year and learned that not really my cup of tea. And... then I worked in a factory again. And I remember the room I was in up there in the folks. I went back and lived with my folks. And, of course, paid room and board. But I can remember the bedroom I had. And I can remember in the midst of my, what in the deuce am I going to do now? I found, And I thought of the little library orientation course, a little one-hour course in Beloit College, where I'd gone. And library, hey, people work in libraries. I wonder. And I wrote down to the University of Illinois Library School, and why, yes. And in fact, we are just now, this coming school year, instituting a new program whereby the first graduate degree will be a master's degree instead of the old-fashioned graduate bachelor's degree. And how lucky can you be? I had to take a big summer session load as necessary, prerequisites, and but then just a year of study, and I had my master's degree, and my wife, who already had University of Minnesota undergraduate bachelor's and a Northwestern University graduate Bachelor of Music, and the old BSLS, Bachelor of Science, Library Science, from the University of Illinois. She already had three bachelors, and by golly, if she didn't pick up another bachelor. And we've been together ever since. And our first job was in Milwaukee, Public Library. She came up for a visit. I came up a week or so later and joined her. Her dad said, well, see, you know, they've got a new library down at the, what did he call, down at the farm school. His name for the, what was then NDAC and is now NDSU, he may have called it the farm school or the ag school or something like that. I forget what he called it. But he said, they've got a new library building down there. Maybe you want to go look at that. I went to look at it, wandered around with the librarian then. His first name was Dean. It was Dean Stallings. And he was very proud of his new building and wondered what my plans were. And I said, well, we're in a public library, working in a public library right now. But I eventually want to get over to, I want to get work in a college library. Well, say, I don't think they found a replacement for old lady, oh dear now, my predecessor here, Haskins. That's not the right name. I don't have it now. Well, let's just say it's Hawkins, but it wasn't. That's not right. I don't think they found a replacement for old lady Hawkins yet. You might want to go over and talk to them. So I went over and talked to them, and the rest is history, I guess. I saw President Snar. Isn't that a wonderful name? Otto Welton Snar. Can you imagine what he went through as a little kid with the name Otto? Not only the name Otto, but Snar. And, you know, Snar Hall, where you're getting on. Yeah. But he was all right, but I've been fascinated by that name. And so that I got to be at Morehead State.
And how many years were you librarian?
Oh, just the 30 years, 50 to 80. I retired in 1980, and we fixed up my wife's home out on the farm, and that's where we're living now, out on the timber claim farm, which is commonly, they're commonly called tree claims now, but actually in the act from the 1870s, they were timber, the word timber was used. So it sounds a little bit fancier than tree claim, timber claim.
Bernie, do you have any final thoughts about what you went through during your time with the military?
Except for the fact that I just am so very happy to be here, and that I couldn't have been more lucky, because I'm able to say, well, sure, I'm a veteran of foreign wars. I'm an overseas veteran. I was in the war. But how lucky can you be? As I mentioned, Andrew was the only time we were under bombardment. No trouble. The invasion became the occupation. Couldn't be luckier. But there are two thoughts. We're increasingly coming to the view that war is failure. You know, war is failure. If you can't arrive at peaceful solutions, You failed, so you have to go to war. The war is failure. And also, I wonder, it's been a long time now. There have been small skirmishes, like the North Dakota National Guard was sent over to Iraq. That stuff over there when Saddam was messing things up. People have been in, but there's been no great big, you know, big war since Vietnam. I don't remember any major goings on. And I wonder if we, just as a culture, we need to find some other means of giving young people the feeling that they're undergoing some kind of tension and pressure so that they feel this feeling of, boy, I've been through that. I've paid some dues. I'm acceptable. What do kids do nowadays? They just kind of, there may not be any big deal for them. We do not have, apparently the old, we call them savages. If you killed a lion or a bear or something, there's a term for that. The anthropologists have a term for that, rite of passage or something. I forget what it is. But you killed your bear and you were a man. You proved yourself. We have nothing like that. We've got cigarettes and dope and stuff like that to serve as, boy, look at me now. I'm tough and I'm big and I'm grown up. I can snort. I guess you, I don't know, what do you snort? You snort marijuana or smoke marijuana or snort? You snort cocaine or you get drunk and die over, wasn't it right here at NDSU where a student, I think a young student died of alcohol poisoning? But anyhow, it often, all too often happens in the fall when freshmen come to campuses, whether it's Atlantic or Pacific. And what do we have, you see, to prove, you know, I am now a man, I am now a woman? We miss something like that. And the fellows that got through the war and home safe, or were missing an arm or a leg or so, they didn't figure they had to prove anything. But war isn't the right way to do it. No.
No. Bernie, how would you like to be remembered?
Oh. Well, as an administrator, a facilitator, someone who wasn't, if he was the brightest person on the staff, he'd failed. You better hire people that know more than you do and are smarter than you are, because otherwise, why hire them? But the administrator makes it possible for them to do things, opens the pathway, the facilitator. That'd be just fine I think that'd be an honorable memory, to have been somebody who made things possible. And, I suppose pride and ego and all that. I try to be nice to people. And the thing that I had the clerk in the sheriff's office, I asked her, is there any way of getting a copy of that? And she made a copy of it. 101 things to say to children. And just little tiny things, you know. And I think the first word was, wow. And it went on to, you made my day. And just all kinds of things like that. It's nicer to build people up than to step on their toe.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Oh, my.
Before we wind this up?
Well, As I've characterized it, how lucky can I be? There were fellows who really went through a lot more and tougher times than I did. And I just recognize how lucky I was.
That's great.
A very lucky person.
Well, thank you very much, Bernie Gay.
Mm-hmm. Fine.
Thank you.
How's that for...